my gosh, we're back for another week of the Rational Revolution. What's up, revolutionaries? You've got Mark Becker here as your, you know, trusted host, or I hope you trust me. Anyway, I have a fantastic, every week we try to bring you the best of the best. And let me tell you, I think this dude here is probably the smartest person I've ever spoken to. And it's always, you know, if it's the, my goal in anything that I do is I want to be the dumbest person in the room, because then I think that I will pick up on things and I will learn. As long as you can be that sponge, being the dumbest person in a room is never, ever a bad thing. I've got a guy, Jeff Cabaservis. He is the Vice President of Political Studies at the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C. What's up, sir?
Hey, good to be with you, Mark. I got to say that given that intro, I am going to give me 5 minutes before I do something really dumb to say.
Oh, I'm not done with my intro yet, because, you know, I got to know you when I wrote a nice scathing article about Ron Johnson, and I was brought into a couple Zoom calls with you and your team, and it was really, I was taken back because I was really the dumbest person in the room on that thing. But to see what you have done, you've written several books, including Rule and Ruin, which I picked up last night, actually. I saw that and I'm like, I need to read this. And your work revolves around centrism, moderation, history of the GOP, which is like, hey, that's what we do here. And in your career, you've written for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Political, The Guardian, assistant professor at Yale. So, I mean, we can keep going on and on here. And so anything dumb that you do in the next 5 minutes is totally, it's good. So tell me, what is the Niskanen Center?
The Niskanen Center is a sort of medium-sized think tank in Washington, D.C. And we had sort of an interesting origin story. Most people have heard of any think tank in D.C. They've heard of Brookings, and they've also heard of the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian organization. And most of the people who formed the Niskanen Center came out of Cato. Wow. They were dyed-in-the-wool libertarians. But then over time, they started maybe getting a little less sure of their faith. And in particular, the issue of climate was a big problem for Jerry Taylor, who ended up becoming the founder of the Niskanen Center. For like 20 years, he'd been paid to be Cato's lead climate change denial spokesperson.
Oh, wow.
And was nationally known in that role and was kind of lionized by a lot of, you know, very right-wing groups. And then one day he had this sort of Saul on the road to Damascus moment of conversion. He said, actually, you know, climate change is happening. It's caused by humans. It's a problem. We should do something about it. So he promptly got forced out of Cato and with some other like-minded people formed the Niskanen Center. And it used to have a pretty libertarian organization, Niskanen. And I would say we're still pro-market, and I would generally consider us to be on the center right. But we've dropped a lot of the original libertarianism that characterized us when we were founded about 10 years ago.
And it's, what's interesting is, you know, if you talk about what you guys do to the average Joe Blow on the street, they have no idea what the Niskanen Center is. But you talk to someone who's on the Hill, you know, member of Congress, staff, whatever, they all are very well aware of you guys and what you do, because you are very influential you know, the things that you've done and been involved with it's very meaningful.
Well, thanks. You know, what we try to do, to be honest, which maybe does differentiate us in Washington, is that we try to speak to people on both sides of the aisle.
Yes.
In Congress. We talk to Republicans as well as Democrats, and especially are involved with their staff. And what we're trying to do, to use a fancy inside the Beltway term, is to provide legislative subsidy. Mm. When they want to govern, we want to help them do what they want to do. And that's what our policy experts are here to do. I'm not a policy expert. I actually am one of these sort of free floating public intellectuals who hangs out there at 35,000 feet and tries to make sense of it all. And I'm not sure I always succeed or even succeed very often, to be honest.
Well, let's try to make sense of some of this. I want to start by kind of looking at how did we get here?
You know, oh, man.
Right.
Where do you want to start?
Well, and you know, I don't know, because my theory, and I talked to a couple people, and I think it was Michael Steele, and I said, well, you know, this, it really, for me, when I saw it going into hyperdrive, it was Sarah Palin with like the death panels of the Obamacare stuff and all, like that was, but it goes back so much farther.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to go back into the whole history of the Republican Party, but the party has almost always been a factionally organized party. At any given moment in the party's history, there's going to be a relatively moderate faction and a relatively conservative faction. But those identities change a lot over time. What you really start to see with the rise of the conservative movement as we understand it is that a lot of people in that faction did not want to play ball with the other factions. And the goal of the people around Bill Buckley and eventually Barry Goldwater starting in the 50s and 60s was to force everybody else out of the party. And, you know, I recently reviewed Max Boot's biography of Ronald Reagan, and it's a fairly critical biography. I think it's a good biography. It's solid. It reflects more than a dozen years of research and hard work. But I think Max somewhat underestimated how good of a politician Reagan was within the Republican Party in raising up the conservative faction, giving them power within the Republican Party, which they had really for the first time ever when he came into office in 1980, but also preventing them from destroying everybody else who didn't agree with them on everything, and creating space for a big tent party that would include moderates as well as conservatives. And over time, that arc was lost. And, you know, what we're seeing now is in a curious way, a repetition of history. You know, eventually the conservatives, once they didn't have Ronald Reagan's guidance anymore, forced out those moderates as they had really been wanting to do for so long. And for a while they ruled the party on their own. And this actually cost them the ability, I think, to get popular majorities in presidential yes. elections. However, now what we're seeing is the Trumpites are forcing out the Reaganites. So what comes around goes around, and they're experiencing the same thing that they did to the moderates back in the day. But now we're talking about an even smaller popular base for the Republican Party if the Trumpers succeed in having their way.
Was it Reagan himself that did that, or did he have really good advisors, or who was behind kind of that big tent thing? Because I subscribe to the big tent theory. I think that's amazing, and we should get back there. But that is not where the Republican Party is right now. It's litmus tests and loyalty pledges and all of that stuff that rules the day with the GOP.
You know, I really do think it was Ronald Reagan more than his advisors
okay.
Who understood the importance of that big tent. And, you know, Reagan wasn't always that way. He first came onto the political scene in 1964 when he gave a speech for Barry Goldwater. Yep. And he was not about coexistence. You know, he was with Barry Goldwater, which is that, you know, if you're not with us, you're against us. But, you know, people tend to forget this, but Barry Goldwater lost massively to Lyndon Johnson. And that also wiped out the Republican Party really down the ticket. And that gave Lyndon Johnson the opportunity to pass what amounted to a second New Deal. It gave the Democrats a bigger opening than they had had since the 1930s. And that was a strategic disaster for the Republican Party. And I think Ronald Reagan learned from that, you know, ideological purity is actually a damaging thing in politics. You actually need to win big popular majorities for your way of thinking. And he also had a saying that a lot of his aides repeated, which is that Reagan said, you know, I want to get 80% of what I want rather than go off the cliff with my flag flying. And he didn't actually really have a lot of respect for the extremists, as he saw it, who were willing to accept defeat, maybe even eager to accept defeat, rather than get most of what they wanted.
Yeah, here we're talking with Jeff Cabaservice, Vice President of Political Studies at the Niskanen Center. How was Reagan received by the left?
Well, the left never really understood what Ronald Reagan was about, and, you know, always saw him as this crazy cowboy figure who was going to take America back to the dark ages and so forth. You know, it's only in relatively recent years that there's been a strange new respect on the left,
right.
Ronald Reagan, because they can see the difference between right. Trump right. and Reagan.
Right. And so, okay, we have Goldwater, we have Reagan, and then we had Richard Nixon, who, I mean, other than, you know, that whole thing, he was actually pretty, I mean, when was the last time he won, what was it, almost every state in his second election?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he had a massive landslide popular. In 1972.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, I mean, but Richard Nixon, we tend also to forget this, was somebody who had a very liberal side to him.
Yeah.
In fact, my friend John Price wrote a book based on his experience in the Nixon administration, which is called The Last Liberal Republican. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you can actually see that, because although Nixon, I think, was at heart more of a populist and, you know, had the Southern strategy in place to get the South voting for Republican, which, you know, ultimately paid long-term dividends for the party, although obviously that came with costs. But, you know, yeah. he also was responsible for the creation of the EPA,
Yeah.
And OSHA and a lot of other things that are just absolute bête noires to conservatives nowadays.
Right. And so it's crazy how, you know, Republicans were, they govern as like the minority party that has to, you know, vote by, win by suppressing others instead of like, hey, these are our ideas. We think big, we do big, but we can explain why we're doing this. And where is that today?
I mean, again, I'm afraid this comes back to the uniqueness of Ronald Reagan. You know, I mean, the Republicans truly were in the political wilderness once Franklin Roosevelt came into office. And not only did they have a hard time winning the presidency from the 1930s onwards, but, you know, it was 40 years before Republicans really had control of the House of Representatives again. And even then, you know, they only regained control by Newt Gingrich deciding that he would destroy Congress as an institution
right.
so that Republicans could inherit the ashes. And, you know, there's obvious problems that come from that. But I'm afraid, you know, there's never really been, aside from the Reagan years, a sense of Republican confidence that their ideas had a majority of popular support, that they could persuade people who were at the margins, and that they could govern more effectively than the Democrats.
It's interesting. I got to know when I was chairman of the GOP, I got to know our Congressman Reid Ribble really well. And when he, you know, he was swept into power into the Tea Party wave. But when, you know, he joined No Labels, and he went as someone who, I mean, he didn't abandon his conservative principles, but he went into this or this group to talk about how we can work together. And he was excoriated by the base here in town.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it shouldn't be this divisive, frankly. You know, and Americans throughout history, I think, understood that everyone's got some conservative and liberal impulses within them. You know, left and right run through the human heart. And there is no one best way to accomplish any of the goals of government. And furthermore, to govern really requires you to compromise with people who don't agree with you and to make your case to them and to work with them. But, you know, in recent years, politics has become some weird combination of entertainment and theology. And the idea now is that you are just betraying everything that is true, good, and beautiful by talking to members of the evil opposing side.
Right.
And that's not a recipe for successful democracy.
No, you're exactly right. And we're going to continue this discussion. We're going to map out the 2024 election here with Jeff Cabaservice from the Niskanen Center right after this.